I'm a firm believer that inclusive education is the first step to an inclusive society and to an inclusive world. One of my favorite quotes is something that I think can be applied to so many different aspects of inclusion, and not just in schools, but it's from Nicole Anderson, who says, "We cannot close the educational gaps that we see in our schools if we don't close the ones we see in our minds first."
That's Ali Tashi, the Vice President of National Programs at the Autism Society of America. I'm Tim Villegas. Welcome to Think Inclusive, a podcast that features conversations about inclusive education and what inclusion looks like in the real world. This week, the last week of Autism Acceptance Month, we are talking with Ali about how we can take what we know about how inclusion works in our schools to our community. More after a quick break.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, glad you are back. Here is a little bit about our guest. Ali Tashi holds a master's degree in leadership and organizational development and a bachelor's degree in exceptional education with certification in autism. She has served the disability community for over 17 years as an educator, advocate, learner, and leader fueled by coffee and fierce passion for disability justice. Ali specializes in designing systems, programs, and practices that foster inclusion and belonging, create access, and promotes long-term systems change through principles of universal design, strategic change management, and community organization. Ali lives in Wisconsin with her nature-loving family. When her adventures in parenting pause, she loves reading, live music, dark chocolate, and great conversations with friends around a campfire. Now, we're not around a campfire today, but we do have a fantastic conversation with Ali. And this week's episode, and all our episodes this April, are sponsored by the Autism Society. We're going to learn a lot about the Autism Society of America in this conversation, so I'm not going to read the full ad copy here. But what I'd love for you to do is, after the episode, or even while you're listening, find out if there is a local Autism Society affiliate in your area. And whether you're an educator, a family member, or autistic individual, see how you can get involved. And now, my interview with Ali Tashi. Oh, and stick around for free time this week. I spoke with the co-founder of a tech startup called Open Door Code that is trying to make coding accessible for all learners. You're not going to want to miss it. Allie Tashi, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thank you. It's a really full circle moment for me to be here as a, you know, listener first. So thank you for having me.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you for listening. It's like a longtime listener, first time guest.
I think it's even like follower before listener, you know, like.
Okay.
So congrats on 11 years.
Yeah, it's been a long time. It's been a long time. So appreciate that. Well, we're here to talk about inclusive education, but let's get started talking about you and why inclusive education is important to you.
Wow. That can get pretty deep, but because it's been so central to who I am, it's not often that I think about its origin, but I think that, you know, that inclusive fire has kind of just been burning within me for at least the last 17 years, if not since birth. I'm the daughter of an ELL teacher and the granddaughter of a high school special education teacher. So I always had like inclusive models in my life, and I knew I wanted to be an educator. I never looked back. But inclusive education kind of found me. I was in high school and wanted to do the youth tutoring youth program that my school had. It was designed to pair up high school students that were interested in the field of education with elementary schools or middle schools. But it took two class periods to be able to do it. And I only had one class period that was open in my schedule. So they're like, we could put you in the basement. I'm like, what's in the basement? You know, sure enough, that's where the classrooms that, you know, they called the CDS room for cognitive disability severe at the time.
You know, it, okay.
With the students that they called the CDS kids, you know, even though half of them were older than me as a sophomore. And I felt that fire of like, why have we not been connected before? And I think I've just kind of been fueled by disability justice really ever since. I worked in, you know, summer camps and in group homes and then in classrooms and schools and in districts. But I think it really started for me in that high school experience. And then as a camp counselor, you know, I served kids, teens and adults, really older adults. And I felt this kind of simultaneous sadness and optimism because, you know, I'd get sad hearing the stories of some of the 40 and older campers whose light had just been dimmed, just like knowing that they had had that lifetime of exclusion. And then knowing that optimism, knowing that the younger campers wouldn't have that same experience and that things were getting better. But I think I've just always known and been driven by that, like, better is not enough. The injustice of it all, you know, I saw
that, that really resonates with me. I've been asked a lot about, you know, why I started in the work. And it's very similar. Like once you saw the injustice, like you couldn't unsee it. Right.
And feeling like I was working at a group home and I had the pleasure of, you know, supporting a 50-year-old who had never lived in a community setting before. It was his first transition to a community setting. He became sick and he was in the hospital and I went to visit him and he said, LD aid, which is how he referred to me, you don't work on Tuesdays. And in that moment, I said, well, I'm not here to work. I'm here because I care about you. You know, I want to spend time with you. And he started crying and it was just like, it hit me, that concept that he had that awareness that people were paid to be there for him. And that it was kind of the first time that, you know, he had realized that somebody was there because they genuinely cared.
Yeah.
And that was the reality for so many people so long. So.
Are you familiar with I don't know what to call it, but it's called Circle of Friends. It's like a person's I'm going to say it wrong. There's a circle of friends, like the organization who we've had on the Think Inclusive before, but this is something that I learned about, and I think it, I don't know exactly where it originated. I should know that. But it's kind of like a thing that you can do with a school community for an individual learner, right? And yeah. There's this activity where you have like these concentric circles, and then you plot where the students' relationships are in those circles, right? And it's meant yeah. to like illustrate for the class or the community that you are including the person with the disability, to illustrate like, see, for you, for people who are typically developing or people who, you know, are just naturally included, that they have a lot of people in the center, like a lot of really close friends, a lot of, you know, people that they interact with. But for people who have been historically excluded, the vast majority of people are on the outside, which are the paid people. You know, yeah. you are paid to work with this person and have a relationship with this person. And it's like way disproportionate.
Yeah, I think we started using some of those in, I remember actually a student teaching placement where we were talking about charting across the life course and thinking about how the circle of relationships builds from there. But I actually think I've used the circles curriculum in some of the like the health middle school health classes that we've used mm-hmm. to kind of articulate some of that. And seeing it up close, you know, is one part. And my own circle shocked me. You know, I was been kind of obsessively consuming everything about autism since, I don't know, 2007. And my mom was already a special education teacher. She's like, do you think that maybe I have Asperger's? And I at the time was touted by others in my building as the autism specialist, right? Like the autism expert, even though I knew how like backwards that was. And I was like, no, you know, because of all of these reasons. Now I'm like, wow, she is the textbook, like autistic. and wow. She now identifies as on the spectrum and has gone through that process. And it's a full circle moment for me too. So that's when I said maybe since birth, because I've also kind of been incubated in autistic culture. And I was raised by, you know, my mom singularly. So it's interesting to me how those circles can not only be like a structural circle of support, but the cultural circles of support around that, and how it's really like the personal connections that kind of help you to transcend from one level of, you know, the circle to the next.
Right, which is why inclusive schooling, inclusive classrooms is so important, because if you don't have relationships or connections with people who are different, then you certainly miss out, right, on all those relationships. But when you encounter somebody that's different, it's it could be scary, right? Not because it should be, but because it is, because it's different.
Yeah, because of basements.
Because of basements. Because of basements. Exactly. You
know, I kind of always knew that within special education, like I wanted to support the students with the most complex support needs. I've always been I've always connected there. And when I was going through school placements, I would have professors telling me, you know, based on your interest profile, like you really want an autism unit. You know, you really want to find an autism unit, and oh, you'll love this so much. And so I thought that's what I wanted for a while too, you know, because I was still learning about what inclusive ed looks like. And by the time I graduated, it was clear to me, like, no, I want to work in an inclusive district. So had researched districts that were practicing inclusion. And I was really fortunate to start my career in a district where students went to their home schools and, you know, where I didn't have a special education classroom that I managed. I was a learning strategist, which was my title, where, you know, we co-planned and co-served. And when things got hard, I just always went back to that knowledge of what the alternative is. So, you know, knowledge of what is the alternative to doing the right thing, even when it is hard sometimes. And honestly, Tim, I listened to your podcast and into that inclusive educator community and was just so lucky, like Katie Novak and Allison Posey and Shelley Moore and all of the mentors that, you know, that I've been able to have as well have just kind of given that like community validation, innovation, and just that's what's kept the fire going, I guess.
Wow. So how long were you an educator?
I was in the classroom for about 6 years, and then I was in coaching and administrative leadership roles for about 5 years. I was so fortunate to be a part of early UDL pilots, you know, at the school that was really putting its structure into educational equity for all and supporting the staff through that support that we know that we all need to get to that place of inclusion. But I don't think I've ever stopped. So that's a hard question. You know, when I think about how long have I been educating, it's been for so long.
Yeah, that's true. I think I probably, I didn't do a great job asking that question because I would consider myself still an educator
right.
in some ways. I just don't work for public schools, a public school district. But
before that, you know, I mean, so much of what I learned was from some of those direct service roles. And I've been serving the community since I was in braces.
There you go. And now you're part of the Autism Society. So what led you to that organization specifically? And then we can talk about kind of your role there.
So when I started moving into more of the coaching roles, and you know, my focus was always, the center was always inclusion, but my focus changed from my classroom to a school and then to district-wide inclusion. And I got really nerdily into systems level practices for, you know, educational equity. And the move into the Autism Society was a little slow for me. I started as a board member at my local Autism Society, Greater Wisconsin, and I, you know, chaired their program services committee. And I was getting to exercise all of the things that got me really excited, things that I was able to really just kind of feel fulfilled by the work that was happening at that time as a member of the Autism Society's board. So when a position opened up at their national team, I really saw that as, you know, the opportunity to then move to systems level practices at more of the community level as a whole. And my role, you know, it sounded to me what they were looking for as a leader of national programs for an affiliate network was a lot like the work I was already doing. I was identifying bright spots and practices across districts and state level to develop that programming, to develop supports and provide staff education and training and, you know, develop resources that would really meet the needs to drive educator efficacy and kind of driving best practice, driving inclusive practices, evidence-based practices. And now I work to identify bright spots in programming across the country within our affiliate network instead of within a district. And, you know, the resources, the education, the content has changed, but a lot of the goal and the way that we go about building capacity for inclusive practices, it's a lot of the same work. So it seems like a natural evolution with inclusion really at the core.
Tell us how the Autism Society is equipping communities to be you know, more inclusive for people on the autism spectrum, but, you know, just for everyone?
Well, inclusion has been the foundation of, you know, the Autism Society's core goals since we launched in 1965. We are the largest and oldest grassroots organization. And our core services are really centered around advocacy and public policy, education, information and referral, and then community education and support programs. So as I mentioned, there's like the bright spots across the country. We have over 70 affiliates, and each of them have their own programs, their own, you know, resources that are making a really big difference in their local communities. And I have the privilege to learn from that and identify how we can utilize the work that's being done at the grassroots level to create, you know, national change. Inclusion's been that foundation. And we, you know, we practice autism acceptance. We promote autism acceptance, rather moving away from awareness, which says, you know, I see you, I see that you might have different needs, and acceptance that says, I see that, you know, this world wasn't built to meet all of your needs. And there are things that I can be doing to help promote that inclusion and belonging. I lead our national programs team, and we focus on building community connections that bridge gaps faced across the autism community. We have core programs of safety on the spectrum, which includes law enforcement training. We have drowning prevention efforts and an accessible learn to swim program. We have an employment initiative and a health equity initiative, and a national helpline, which is our information and referral, you know, call center. But really, you know, while each of those programs has different focused goals, across the team, we're working to bridge those gaps and fill the community gaps really by centering intersectionality, inclusion, all through connection.
What I really love about the Autism Society's messaging, and it comes across to, you know, to me as someone who works in communications, but just as someone who's getting to know more and more about the organization, is that y'all feature disabled autistic individuals and their voices and their stories in, you know, in your communications and in your programs. Specifically, like, I'm learning about your autistic, I'm going to say this wrong, your board of autistic advocates?
Council of Autistic Advisors.
There you go. That's it. So I'd love to know more about that and why that is important to the work of the Autism Society.
One of the things that makes me, you know, feel really proud to work at the Autism Society is the fact that beyond featuring the voices within our community, we're amplifying those voices and amplifying, you know, and honoring the diversity of needs, diversity of wants, goals, dreams, because central to the autistic experience is that no two experiences of autism will be the same. Same for parents and caregivers, you know, no two experiences within the community are going to be the same. And everyone deserves not only to have their voice to be heard, but, you know, to be known, to be supported, to be empowered, and to be accepted. So that's been really core to our organization since, you know, we opened our doors. I think it actually out of kitchens, you know, where at the time it was parents who were getting together in their homes to, you know, talk about their experiences and to work together to advocate for improved support for their children. And then it was parents working with teachers, you know, working together to gain access to services and supports. And the, you know, the advocate community grew with a lot of professionals that were disability serving, to, you know, people with disabilities and autistic advocates sharing their own ideas, thoughts, needs, feelings. And that kind of paradigm shift, or not really a paradigm shift, I guess, but that evolution of you know, disability justice and of history within the disability community, which we've, you know, has been mimicked then in the autism community. We've been there throughout each step, and we've remained committed to supporting everyone in the autism community, but doing it together and doing it in a way that honors and validates and amplifies the wide range of lived experiences that we have.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
What about the rebranding? Because I know that the rebranding happened, what, like in the last couple of years? Is that right?
Yeah, we relaunched in 2021, in November of 2021. And, you know, I wasn't a part of the organization during the conception of the rebrand. So it was actually shortly after I joined the organization that we went through this this process. But the brand itself was over 20 years old, and it no longer served the needs of the community. So if you're familiar, you know, with the ribbon of puzzle pieces, that's our old logo. But that lacked the, you know, the inclusive values and the connective values of the organization. It didn't center the autism community anymore. And we heard from people time and time again, not just at the Autism Society, but, you know, within the disability community, you know, specifically talking about, I'm not broken. You know, I'm not a puzzle that needs to be solved. I'm not a problem that needs to be fixed. I'm a human that needs to be supported. And that, in a nutshell, you know, is a lot of what came out of the work that was done, where, you know, we had focus groups. We leaned into hundreds of, you know, personal experiences and really went through the process of redesigning. So from the start, you know, we set out to create a space that was fully inclusive and accepting and representative of everyone in the autism community. It was designed with the autism community, and it's an expression of the community. So when you look at the shift, the visual shift away from using the puzzle piece towards what we now have as interconnected threads, it's really a recognition of the diversity of experiences and the different connection points within the community. So we are continuing to go back to that, because some folks are like, oh, are you a new organization? We're like, no, we're the same old Autism Society as we've been, but we have a new symbol of community and strength and, you know, connection.
Right. And some people may not realize how large y'all are. You have a national, you kind of have the, you know, your national, I don't know, the national organization, but you also have, you call them affiliates, right? Local affiliates.
Yep. So I call it the Autism Societies of, you know, across the country.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And how many of those affiliates are there across the country?
Across the country, we have about 70 affiliates. And I say about, because there's a different structure even within some of the affiliates, where there might be three autism societies within one state, Whereas there might be one affiliate at the state level who has their own chapter network across different kind of metro hubs. So it's a large network, and it's an aligned network in that, you know, we're all committed to the mission of creating connections that empower everyone with the resources that they need to live fully. And we learn from each other. We, you know, very much so remain a grassroots organization driven by the different governance structures that we have nationally. We have a Council of Autistic Advisors. We have a panel of professional advisors. Our board is like many of the smaller affiliate boards, and those affiliates have their own groups that, you know, some have AAC users groups, some have autistic adult groups that are focused on employment. Some have, LGBTQIA plus peer support groups. There's so many different communities within the community, and that all, you know, creates that interconnected piece that is central to who we are.
Yeah. The way you were describing it sounds almost like alive. You know, like it's just, there's a lot of going on. So, I want to turn to how this could benefit educators, because we have lots of people who listen, you know, a lot of different roles. But the majority of people are, you know, teachers in public schools, private schools, charter schools, administrators, you know, superintendents. So people in the education space wanting to move inclusive education forward. So what kinds of resources are available to educators that they could possibly use to support families and individuals on the autism spectrum?
I think the connection through our community is a first step. You know, I mentioned when I was feeling like exhausted by the prospect in front of me, I turned to the community that you've created here and other inclusive ed communities, you know, UDL communities. But turning to the autism community as an educator, whether autism is new to you and you have a student who is in your classroom for the first time, or, you know, you're obsessively consuming all things autism in your spare time. One of the things that I think really is the first place to start is identifying if you have a local community, a local affiliate within your community, and also recognizing that there are some virtual programs and opportunities. And just like we like to share resources and create resources, we love to hear about what are the things that are most needed. So our national helpline is our information and referral hub, and we have a lot of educators that contact us looking for additional resources, looking for information, looking for guidance to share with families. Some of our local affiliates have local next step resource guides that have been provided at the school level, and programs where we can come in. Some affiliates do IEP advocacy and training within school buildings. And, you know, it's something that the door is always open. And I'm really excited about what educators can bring to the Autism Society, just as much as I am about what the Autism Society can bring to, to educators. This spring, we're actually going to be launching the Autism Society's Education and Training Center. And that's going to be an opportunity for us to provide training resources, communities of practice that support learning about autism in different communities. So whether it's in schools or whether it's, you know, at the doctor or in the grocery store, we're really working on improving access to additional learning and training, because that is what is necessary, not only in schools, but really in all of the communities that we're serving. You know, we're identifying that there is a desire. Everyone wants, most people want to be inclusive practitioners. But just like we know that, you know, educators need better training and support to implement all of the inclusive practices that they're taught, we need to give that same support to others in our community as well. And I think educators are paving the way for that broader community inclusion in a big way.
I like what you said about educators paving the way to inclusive practices, because especially if you already have an inclusive mindset and are implementing these practices in schools, it also means that you can implement them wherever you are, right? So, like, how can we take what we know works in schools and apply it to other aspects of our world and community?
I think that we just have to start. The practices that we know are working, some of, talk about evidence-based practices for autism instruction and intervention. Well, what parts of those evidence-based practices can open doors outside of school? We're using, social narratives, visual schedules, visual supports, communication supports. Those aren't just applicable to classroom settings, but because they're just mandated and trained within classroom settings, sometimes they get stuck there. And the work that we're doing on our team is really helping other people to learn about these different practices that can make a big difference. But with anything, just like in schools, I think it does start with belief, the belief factor. And from a theoretical standpoint, I love Eric Carter's 10 Dimensions of Belonging, Shelley Moore's 5 P's, and Anthony Muhammad's work about transforming culture. I love Paul Gorski's Fix Injustice, Not Kids principle. And all of those really start with belief. And, I think it's not just about presuming competence and believing in a person's ability, but it's also about believing in your own ability to support diverse needs. And that's the work that we're trying to do in, a lot of different settings, because really what I've learned since making the jump from schools into community settings is that a lot of the same concepts that drive inclusion in schools can be applied, almost anywhere. take the L out of UDL. And this is a concept. Universal design in general is something that I'm hearing corporate leaders about, who are dedicated to neurodiversity in the workplace, having conversations about. And schools didn't just figure out how to implement UDL. There were the principles, there were the pillars, there's the guidance and the examples of how do you move through all of those pieces. So I think just like teachers need coaching, so do employers and doctors and restaurant, leaders. And there's not a magic wand, but if there was a magic wand, schools would be the one to be holding it. And I think we have to figure out how to kind of pass that wand baton, if you will.
Well, what do you want teachers to walk away with from this conversation?
We can't do any of this without you. As teachers, we so often struggle to give ourselves the same grace that we give to our students. And we build entire programs about self-regulation to support other people around us, but we oftentimes struggle to prioritize our own personal care. And I think it's so important because I'm a firm believer that inclusive education is the first step to an inclusive society and to an inclusive world. And, that's what I meant by they're paving the way, you're foundational. One of my favorite quotes, to leave with is something that I think can be applied to so many different aspects of inclusion, and not just in schools, but it's from Nicole Anderson, who says, "We cannot close the educational gaps that we see in our schools if we don't close the ones we see in our minds first." And that's the work that I hope that we continue to do together. And the connection is you.
Right after a quick break, the mystery question.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What is the oddest job you ever took to earn a buck? This is, I'm just reading it verbatim. Okay.
It has to be my first job. There was one job I had before I discovered disability service fields, and it was as a roller rink, first snack bar attendant, then floor guard, then eventually worked my way up to children's birthday party DJ. But the oddest part of it was that I was one of the only ones on the team who could wear the Rufus the Roller-Roo costume, which picture a very sweaty kangaroo character on rollerblades. And I was really good at doing the limbo and doing the chicken dance in this Rufus the Roller-Roo costume. So that's my claim to fame.
That is really, yeah, that's great. That is great. I don't think I can beat that. I've had a lot of jobs. I don't know if they're really odd though.
I'm curious.
One of the strangest ones I had was like a two-parter. I worked for my uncle, my aunt and uncle. They owned, a security company, like people, they would hire their security guards to work in like warehouses or like a strip mall or something like that. And so this was when I was in college, and I had blown up my car on the highway. I was driving my car, and it broke down. And, yeah, not great, not safe either. I wouldn't recommend it. But my aunt and uncle were like, "Hey, listen, we'll give you this Ford Ranger. If you come work for us, like you just come work for us. And basically you'd be working to pay off the car." And so I'm like, "Hey, great. Awesome. I need a car." And it was this little Ford Ranger Splash with it was a stick shift, and that, you know, so I worked in a strip mall, driving around, and I put I had a uniform and this like security magnet on my car. And I basically was like observe and report. Like I didn't have any sort of like power to do anything. I just
feel powerful?
Watched people. No, I did not feel powerful, and people did not like care that I was there. But I was there. And then I also did like, so I worked there, and I also worked at this manufacturing warehouse that made like roofing tiles. I want to say, I mean, it was a long time ago, so I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And I used to drive around in a golf cart, like in the middle of the night. This is like, I would work from like 10 o'clock till 4 o'clock in the morning. Like, this was not an easy job. Okay. And I would listen to books on tape to keep myself awake, and like literally cassette tapes. So there you go. That's my honest roofing job.
Rufus the Roller-oo.
I see the connection.
You want to know the weirdest thing I ever did as Rufus the Roller-oo?
Yes.
I was in a Brat Days parade. I hail from Wisconsin. We make a lot of cheese, but also brats. And there is a whole Brat Days celebration in my local hometown. And I was in the Brat Days parade as Rufus the Roller-oo, roller skating miles in 85 degree weather. In this giant sweatsuit of a kangaroo. So that's when I knew that I didn't want to do that job anymore. And thankfully I found Camp Evergreen, the next summer serving the community I love. So I never had to go back to the Brat Days parade, but.
There you go. Yes. Yes. I hear you. And I never have to put on a security uniform again. Allie, Tashi, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast. It was a pleasure.
It was sincerely my pleasure.
That chime means it's free time. This week, an interview with the co-founder of Open Door Code, an introductory coding tool that empowers young, blind, and low vision creators by making learning fun, interactive, and accessible. By bringing the world of coding from the screen to their hands, Open Door Code gives middle school students a tactile alternative to traditional beginner coding software. Here's the interview.
My name is Dr. Danielle Campo. I'm the Associate Dean of the Schultz School of Entrepreneurship here at the University of St. Thomas.
And I'm Maria Johnson. I'm a student at the University of St. Thomas, and I'm co-founder of Open Door Code. So the problem we're looking at is today in a lot of schools, even starting as early as preschool, students are able to learn how to code thanks to visual programming languages, where they sort of use like puzzle piece like blocks to write code instead of writing lines of text. But that's just not accessible to their blind and low vision peers, which is why with Open Door Code, we're trying to make that a more tactile experience for them by making physical blocks that they can move around and write code with instead.
Why is accessibility important to you?
I personally grew up loving design. I'm really interested in design. And this fall, I went to a conference about inclusion in science education. And I learned for the first time about the medical and social models of disability. The medical model of disability is kind of the way we've always looked at people with disabilities, just as a society. We see them as they have a problem, they can find accommodations to fix it. But with the social model of disability, which is what we should all move towards, we recognize that we just haven't designed a world that's made for everyone. So as we're designing new products, it's really great to bring in accessible design and make sure that it works for everyone really well.
Dr. Campo, how is this project tied to St. Thomas?
Yeah, thanks for asking. At the University of St. Thomas, we're on a mission to engage students in thinking innovatively about how to advance the common good. We have a newly opened Institute for Social Innovation, and we really promote social impact through innovation and entrepreneurship. Maria and Open Door Code is one example of the types of ideas that we really try to foster and support at our university. We actually start back in the fall with something called the Fowler Business Concept Challenge. And specifically, that has what we call a social innovation track. So we encourage students to think about leveraging innovation and entrepreneurship and understanding how they can have impact on the world. So we support businesses and ideas like Maria's through our series of competitions. It starts with an idea competition. We then go to a business plan competition, which also again has a social track in it. And then it ends with our big national competition. What we're in right now is eFest, a national competition for all undergraduate students across the nation to apply into. It's very competitive. And so we're extremely proud of Maria and Open Door Code for getting into this competition and really making an impact on the world.
Best case scenario, you receive funding and you're able to go forward with this project. What happens if you don't receive funding? Will the project continue? Will you continue to look at other avenues to get funding?
I'd love to just continue exploring. The company right now is really in a product development stage, getting to our customers. So I'll definitely continue talking to more people about it and been building a network recently and being here, so many people to talk to. So that's really the first step, is getting to know what the students really need and designing the best product for them. So I'll definitely keep going with that for sure.
And then as far as the actual product, right now it's just in a development phase. Is there anything tangible?
We have been able to 3D print some blocks already, and we got Braille on there, which is super exciting. And I had one of my fellow students who reads Braille test them out, and he was able to read them, and that made me really excited. Just that one part was ready to go and nice. Talked to a bunch of computer science students too, playing around with the blocks. And recently we've been getting some feedback from teachers at the Metro Deaf School in St. Paul, Minnesota. A lot of them teach deafblind students as well. Just testing it out with a lot of people, and we've gotten some feedback on what technology could help the blocks communicate with a computer or robot or something like that. So very exciting.
What do you want educators to think about as far as creating accessible spaces and products for schools?
First of all, there's a lot of us students out here who are really excited about innovation and would just love to help these teachers. For the teachers, I think as someone who's neurodivergent myself, there's just so many amazing, easy ways to make classrooms more inclusive and more welcoming to everyone. And I think so many teachers are already doing a great job with that. And we're starting to see so much more accommodations in schools and everything. But just keep up the good work and supporting their students.
Dr. Campo, any final thoughts?
Yeah, please follow along on efest.biz or find us on LinkedIn at efest, home of the Schultz Entrepreneurship Challenge.
Fantastic. Maria and your team, good luck. Looking forward to hearing some good news. And Dr. Campo, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Open Door Code did not receive funding during the competition, but we wish them luck as they continue with this product to make coding accessible. That's it for this episode of Think Inclusive. Did you like this episode? You can let us know by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or rate us on Spotify. Think Inclusive is written, edited, designed, mixed, and mastered by me, Tim Viegas, and is a production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. Original music by Miles Kredich. Additional music from Melody. Thanks again to our fabulous sponsor, the Autism Society. Learn more at autismsociety.org. Thanks for your time and attention, and remember, inclusion always works. All right, mystery Ooh. Question time. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. I'm not ready because I had to reach for my cards here. Let's just mix them up. I still have a ton of, this is what I have left.
So exciting. This is the best part.
It is so exciting. I like it. I like it.
From MCIE.